Before they developed an effective central government, it seemed that anywhere you turned in Scotland, there was a castle.
At one point, there was up to 3,000, which is about one for every 100 square miles in Scotland.
In just a minute, Scottish tour guides introduce us to their favourite castles to visit. Some are ancestral homes for famous Scottish families, while others were important garrisons against invaders. One of the grandest is Stirling Castle.
It's not a clan castle, it's a defensive castle, one of the oldest castles in Scotland.
Head for the high Atacama Desert in northern Chile, and instead of castles, you'll find giant telescopes scattered about the desert.
Rub shoulders with the scientists during the day and see what they're doing, and then come back at night to look through telescopes at some of the clearest skies you'll find anywhere on Earth.
Mark Johansson takes us to the driest place on Earth. And listeners update us on their memorable adventures. It's in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Flocks of flamingos at 15,000 feet might make you feel like a bit of an alien visitor when you climb to the high deserts of northern Chile. Coming up, journalist Mark Johansson takes us wandering in the Atacama for breathtaking adventures under the clearest skies on Earth. And we're overdue for a check-in with our listeners, so we'll hear about your travel adventures and help you plan for more. We'll start today's Travel with Rick Steves looking for castles in Scotland. Scotland's majestic landscape seems custom-made for castles. Whether perched atop a craggy cliff, nestled in lush glens, or reflected in tranquil lochs, Scotland's castles are where history, legend, and rugged beauty all come together. Today I'm joined by two Scottish guides to help us get the most out of Scotland's most worthwhile castle visits. Liz Lister and Helen Houston are the co-hosts of Scottish Blethers. That's a podcast. And they've been guiding in and around their native Scotland now for nearly 30 years. Helen and Liz, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Scottish castles, it's just a very important part of a visit to Scotland. When you drive around, they just catch your eye. There's so many dramatically situated castles, and so many great cities are built in the shadow of a mighty castle. When we think about Scottish castles, Liz, are they mostly remnants of British imperialism, like you see in Wales, or do they relate more to the clan system, and are they indigenous Scottish?
I think that they're certainly indigenous Scottish. I mean, there are so many of them. At one point, there was up to 3,000, which is about one for every 100 square miles in Scotland. So initially, they were primarily defensive, but latterly, they would become, the English would become the common enemy. But to begin with, it was more your neighbour. You were defending your lands from your neighbour. Up in the Highlands, you've got the clan system, but there were also big families down in the borders in the lowland areas. And so equally, you needed some sort of defensive structure where you could pull yourself into a stone building, pull up the drawbridge and hold out under siege.
Was this before there was an effective central government?
Yes. And then you got to the stage where kings and monarchs would reward loyal servants by granting them land on which they would build a castle. But the castle wouldn't be what it looks like today. It would just be a very simple tower house, a defensive structure. And
right.
There's a good saying which says, a sharp dagger needs no decoration. You know, they didn't need all the status that you see in today's castles. They just needed to provide defence.
Helen, when I go to a castle in Scotland, up in the Highlands especially, I feel like it's sort of the capital of a clan. It's almost like the political and spiritual capital of what was a feudal domain, like a clan. Can you tell me a little bit about how the clan system related to these castles and what's the importance of a castle for the Campbells or the MacDonalds or whatever big Scottish powerful clan?
Yes, that certainly was the idea, that the castle would be the chief's main residence. And we've got today Inverary Castle, which is the residence of the Duke of Argyll, who is chief of the Clan Campbell. And you've got the Dunvegan Castle on Skye, which is the chief of the Clan MacLeods of Skye, her castle or his castle. So they still is. Down in the Highlands, yes, it was very much the main domain, and the chief had the land all around. And he would then allocate portions of that land to his clan members. And they would get a portion and they would pay back the rent in, partly in sort of, you know, money terms, but mainly in kind, where they would give produce from the land, mm-hmm. or they would also turn out for the chief. Wherever the chief decided he was going to fight, whoever he was going to fight, he could guarantee, you know, 25, 55, 205 men, depending how many people, clan members he had, that he was allocating land to.
Liz Lister and Helen Houston are helping us explore the castles of Scotland right now on Travel with Rick Steves. They also host occasional podcast conversations to help you explore Scotland. It's at Scottish Blethers. What are a couple of the best castle interiors to visit, where you see more than just architecture, but you see like a museum for that whole clan's story?
One of the castles that I think you can see really well how people lived and how people still live is Cawdor Castle outside Inverness, because the Dowager Countess still lives in that castle during the winter hours, the winter days, and she is there during the summer working away in the tea room, showing people round. So that's one that you really can see. And there's a little print by Salvador Dali on one of the walls, and her television is hidden behind a screen, you know, or a cupboard on another wall. So you just know that this is a lived-in castle.
Yeah.
But the other castles that I really have to put my hands up and say, I just love Stirling Castle. It's not a clan castle. It's a defensive castle, one of the oldest castles in Scotland. And I grew up, my bedroom window looked out over Stirling Castle. So I grew up in the shadow of that. And what they did when the army marched out of Stirling in 1964, they decided to do the research and refurbish the main rooms of Stirling Castle, the palace, the great hall, the chapel, as they would have looked when they were first built in the 1400s, 1500s or 1600s. And they are such a good visit. You can learn a lot.
I always think of Stirling Castle and Edinburgh Castle as similar. They're both on rocks. They're both very historic. And they're also different than a clan castle.
Yes.
Liz, how are these different than a clan castle that we were talking about before?
Well, it wasn't a clan, it was royalty. So royalty. Stirling Castle that Helen's been talking about, that was during the Stuart era. So people have probably heard of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her son, James VI of Scotland, who united the thrones of Scotland and England. But her father, James V, and her grandfather, James IV, all of them built their own particular buildings in Stirling Castle. So it was royalty. And Edinburgh Castle, it was the same. Although at Edinburgh, they had Holyrood Palace. And if you've ever visited Edinburgh Castle, you'll know that it's pretty windy up there. And we can get this fierce sea mist that blows in off the Firth of Forth called a har. There's another Scottish word for you. So it's said that the monarchs didn't like to live up in Edinburgh Castle. They just went there in times of threat. They preferred the much more sumptuous accommodation down at Holyrood Palace.
But both Stirling Castle and Edinburgh Castle are like museums. If you're interested in the royal history of Scotland, those are two must-see castles. We're taking a look at some of Scotland's best castle experiences today on Travel with Rick Steves. And to help us, I'm joined by Scottish tour guides Helen Houston and Liz Lister. I'd like to talk from a sightseeing point of view about some of the dramatic castles that as you're driving around, you'll see these castles, and they're just, if you were a painter, you'd screech to a halt and set up your easel and paint that image. Helen, when you're taking a group around Scotland, what's one of the best photo op castles that you can remember?
I think one of them, just off the east coast, south of Aberdeen, is Dunottar Castle. And that is sitting almost on a stack out from the cliffs. It's a beautiful castle, just absolutely lovely. And you can visit it, and it's a ruin, but lots of stories. That was where they hid the crown jewels, the honours of Scotland, during Oliver Cromwell's time. And when he was, or his troops were coming to it, they dropped the honours of Scotland out of the castle down to the seashore, where the minister's wife was collecting seashells and seafood. She picked them up and took them to her husband's church and hid them under the floorboards in Kenneth Church. And that is why the honours of Scotland, the crown jewels of Scotland, are the second oldest in Europe, older than the ones in London.
It's so great to know the stories behind all of these great slices of Scottish culture. Liz, for you, what is a beautiful photo op castle?
Well, the prime photo op is the one that's on all the shortbread tins, which is Ealandonan Castle. which is on a promontory just before you cross over the bridge into Skye. So it has the beautiful setting where three lochs all merge together and you've got Coolins and just the beautiful scenery of Éilean Donan. It's probably the most photogenic.
But so you know, Éilean Donan.
Éilean, E-I-L-A-N, which is Gaelic for island, Donan.
And if you're going to Skye, as many of us will, you drive across a bridge. And just before you leave the mainland, on the left, you'll find that castle. It's so beautiful. Hey, we're out of time, but I'd like to just let each of you share one unforgettable surprise extra that comes with a castle. For instance, Urquhart on Loch Ness is where people stop to see if they can find the Loch Ness monster from the lookout tower in that castle. What I also like there is there's an old catapult, and you get to actually see that medieval weapon. What's one surprise, sort of unforgettable extra that you can enjoy in a castle in Scotland? Helen?
Right. Well, I would say, and I'll go back to my favorite one, Stirling Castle. Just looking out over the walls of Stirling Castle, seeing right over what we call the carse, that's the low-lying ground by the river, just looking out over the carse and you're looking down on the King's Knot, which K-N-O-T, which is a beautiful landscaped piece of ground, which they're not quite sure what it was. You think it might have been a formal garden laid out by James VI, or it may well have been some sort of tiered seating for watching the boys and their toys, the men jousting in the haining just alongside it. Just wonderful things, looking right over to Ben Lomond and one or two more of the crag and tail features, which are the sort of the slope and the kind of wedge of cheese type rock formations dotted around Scotland.
And Liz, what would your surprise extra in a castle be?
Well, I think no self-respecting castle would be without a ghost. So, you know, as you walk around a castle, you're looking for that shivery feeling, the cold air around about you. And the most haunted of all of the castles in Scotland is said to be Glam's Castle, which has no less than 6 ghosts, which are reputed to haunt it. One of them was a poor little page boy who was always getting into mischief. And so instead of the naughty step, he was sent to the stone outside in the cold to sit, and they forgot about him. And he sat there on a freezing night and turned to ice and died. So he said to still be mischievous, and he trips up visitors as they're walking around the castle. So if you trip
that sounds so good. Hey, you guys, I can see why your podcast, Scottish Blethers, is such a hit. And I'd like to thank both of you, Helen Houston and Liz Lister, for joining us today and bringing a little bit of the joy and the richness of your culture to our audience. Happy travels and thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Liz Lister explains how some castles in Scotland function as the spiritual heart of a family clan. It's in an extra that you'll find with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Bring along your eye drops as we head next for Mars on Earth in the high and dry Atacama Desert of Chile. It's Travel with Rick Steves. The country of Chile is famous for what must be the world's longest and skinniest country all along the west coast of South America. Yet sandwiched between its high peaks of the Andes and the Pacific coast, 40,000 square miles of northern Chile hosts one of the most extreme environments on Earth. The Atacama Desert is one of the driest places on the planet. NASA uses it to test equipment for Mars. But the otherworldly landscape is also teeming with a surprising mix of life. And beneath its briny salt flats are some of the world's largest stores of lithium, that coveted mineral needed for modern electronics and green energy. U.S.-born travel writer Mark Johansson explores this fascinating region in his book, Mars on Earth. It chronicles his wanderings in the Atacama during a time of personal and political turmoil, as he sought whatever insights the desert might offer into his own life and into his adopted country. He joins us now from his home in Santiago. Mark, thanks for being with us on Travel with Rick Steves.
Oh, thanks, Rick, for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you live in Santiago, the capital city of Chile, right?
That's right, yeah.
And where is that relative to this desert we're talking about, Atacama?
So Santiago is just right in the middle of Chile, and the desert is roughly about a third of Chile, and it's all in the north. So just north of Santiago, about 6 hours, begins the desert.
So you fly into Santiago and then just head north and you find yourself in the driest place on Earth.
Something like that. I mean, a lot of people will fly to get really into the heart of the desert, but you can drive or take a bus. Just depends on what kind of traveler you are.
All right, so the book's called Mars on Earth. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so Mars on Earth has to do a lot with the way NASA has historically looked at this region. So NASA uses the Atacama as an analog for Mars. So when they want to test those instruments that we send up to Mars, you know, they need to be perfect before they go up in orbit. And what NASA has found is that the Atacama is the closest place we have here on Earth to what the land is like up on Mars.
Wow. So now, I mean, it's famously dry, but just how dry is it? I mean, some weather stations there in the desert have never even recorded precipitation.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a legend. That's what everyone says about the desert. There are parts of the desert that do get rain. There are parts that get rain every year. It really depends on the different areas that you're in. But there's a specific area called Yungay, which is where NASA goes when they want to test their instruments for Mars. And they use it because, you know, when you're going up to Mars, you're searching for life, right? That's our mission up there. And so what better place than somewhere that has the least life that you can find on planet Earth?
Now, when you talk about life in a desert that is almost totally dry, there is water. I mean, there's this coastal fog that locals can actually collect, right, to get a little water. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's the Kamanchaca, which is a coastal fog. So a lot of this is a coastal desert, I guess, first would be an important thing to say. And because of that, you get a lot of these clouds that come in from the Pacific, and they bring a bit of moisture with them, but they don't actually drop down as rain.
Okay, so they're cheating a little bit. It's on the coast, so you get a little spillover from the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, anywhere close to an ocean, I think, around the world is going to have a bit of humidity. And so you do get these clouds that come in on the coast, kind of like in a place like San Francisco. And you also, because of the Andes, because they're so tall, you do get a bit of snow melt that comes down in rivers. So there are these little pockets of life, these little oases scattered throughout the Atacama.
So who lives there?
Surprisingly, more people than you would think. There's over 1 million people that live in the Atacama Desert. And because of that
over
moisture,
a million people. It must just be like cheap real estate.
Well, they need to have workers for the mines. You know, this is a very mineral.
Okay, so it's not like indigenous people that have always lived there.
Also, there's that also? Too. So more so up in the Altiplano, as well along the coast. Most of the coastal cities would be people who have moved up there from somewhere else to work in the mining industry or to support the mining industry in other ways. When you get up to the Altiplano, which is the second largest high plateau on Earth after Tibet, that's where you find a lot of these indigenous communities.
Is there a heritage of indigenous people being nomadic, like in other deserts, where they will move from place to place, or do they settle down in ravines and oases?
Yeah, so historically, you have like the Capacnan, the greater Inca road that starts in Cusco and comes all the way down through Chile and Argentina, as well as up to Ecuador and Colombia. And along those routes, you would have these vast llama caravans that people would trade goods on. So it does have all of these signs of life. You have these huge geoglyphs and wild rock art all throughout the desert that speak to its long history of human inhabitants.
Yeah. So when you go there and you have this interesting sort of attraction to it, what does it feel like? I mean, do you make a point to be in a desolate spot? And then what's it like to be there?
That's a good question. This journey made me realize the joy I get out of uncomfortable places. I think a lot of us as travelers, you know, we're automatically attracted to the most comfortable, easiest places that you can find on Earth. And I think sometimes we ought to give the more uncomfortable places a second look because they force us to really look inside of ourselves and feel these really deep, big emotions that we lose when we just travel and plop ourselves down on a beach, for example.
So you're basically a Chilean. You've adopted this country. You've lived there for more than a decade. As a tourist, if I was to come in, I mean, there's activities, stargazing, trekking, and so on. How does a tourist approach the Atacama Desert? What do you do to have an experience?
Yeah, most visitors, if they're coming to the Atacama, they'll end up in San Pedro de Atacama. It's the biggest sort of resort town in San Pedro with a great tourist infrastructure, lots of nice hotels and restaurants. And from there, you can go out and explore volcanoes, and you can go and explore big lagoons filled with flamingos and go on all sorts of different outdoor adventure-y kind of activities from there. if you're into stargazing, you would probably go down to the Elqui Valley, which is in the southern part, technically just outside of the Atacama Desert. But there you have huge astronomy facilities. I mean, 2/3 of the world's astronomy facilities are in the Atacama Desert, and a lot of them are near the Elqui Valley. So you can go, you know, rub shoulders with the scientists during the day and see what they're doing, and then come back at night to look through telescopes at some of the clearest skies you'll find anywhere on Earth.
2/3 of the global infrastructure for astronomy. This is amazing. This must be the ultimate experience for anybody who's a stargazer.
It is. It's the ultimate. And it's not just that you're learning about the scientific perspective of the skies, because one of the interesting things about the Atacama as well is that the indigenous communities who've lived there for millennia have their own way of looking at the stars. So you could go one night and look at the stars from a scientific perspective, and then come back another night and look at the stars from an indigenous perspective, which is totally different because many of the indigenous communities are actually looking for the dark spots in the sky.
Looking for the dark spots. Do they have any kind of herb that they chew on or smoke to make that even darker?
Well, there's a lot of chewing on coca leaves in the Atacama, that's for sure.
Chewing on coca leaves. Tell me more.
Well, coca leaves are the base ingredient famously for cocaine, and it's the ingredient that used to be found in Coca-Cola. Now it's really a sacred herb, not just in the Atacama, but all over Andean South America. So it's an herb that you'll find sort of chewed up and wadded and tossed onto rocks to ask for safe passage in areas. People use it to fight the altitude because much of the Atacama Desert is above 13,000 feet. So it's used for all sorts of different things.
Medicinal.
Medicinal, yes, correct.
Mark Johansson is an American journalist who's been based in Santiago, Chile since 2014. He's taking us along right now on Travel with Rick Steves on his 1,200-mile odyssey through one of the driest places on Earth, the Atacama Desert. He writes about it in his first literary work. It's called Mars on Earth. It was released in 2024 by Rocky Mountain Books. Mark has also co-authored about 20 Lonely Planet guidebooks to the Americas and Asia and contributed to a dozen of their coffee table books. His website is markjohansson.com. So, Mark, we've got the tourists coming there and stargazing and sometimes getting a little more vivid look at the sky, thanks to local herbs or whatever. But it's a serious industrial economy and so on because of the minerals there. I mean, you were talking about lithium, for example, which is a really important mineral in the future and makes this a pretty important bit of real estate. Tell me about the value from a mining point of view of this Atacama Desert.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that I wanted to travel through the Atacama is that it really is what generates the economy for Chile. So Chile is a very much a mineral-based economy. Previously, copper would be the main mineral that people were looking for. Nowadays, it's lithium. So you have companies and, you know, all sorts of nations just planting their flags all across the Atacama at this moment because lithium is the main ingredient in a lithium-ion battery. So that's, you know, what we need to fuel our transition from gas-powered cars to electric ones. So everyone is in search of lithium. But what we don't think about a lot, I think, in the U.S. or Europe or wherever you may be based, is where that mineral comes from and what effect that's having on the communities that are living right next to it. And that's sort of the debate and the conversation that I wanted to have with certain parts of this book.
And the recognition of the mineral wealth in the desert is nothing new. I mean, you wrote about three countries were fighting a war over this back in the 1880s.
Absolutely. So the War of the Pacific is a big war that a lot of people in the U.S. have never heard of, but it really shaped parts of South America. So Chile was fighting against Bolivia and Peru and won that war with a lot of help from the U.K., who was interested in the mining in the Atacama. And so because of that, Chile took over a vast part of what is now the Atacama Desert that used to belong to Bolivia and Peru. And that land has made Chile one of the richest countries in South America. So it's a story that really shaped the future of this country.
Mark, when you say one of the richest countries in South America, does that mean it's one of the richest and best off societies, or is it all taken up by a corrupt gap between rich and poor?
Because exactly.
There's this notion of the curse of natural resources, where a country can be rich in natural resources, Nigeria and oil, for example, and actually it makes their people more miserable. How does that work in Chile?
No, I think you're spot on with that. I mean, Chile is also one of the most divided countries in the OECD, which is this grouping of, you know, middle to high income countries, because the wealthy few in Chile have a vast majority run the economy. There's sort of a saying in Chile, like if you have a winery with your name on it, you're one of these families that run the country. So it is a very unequal society. And that's part of what set me off on this journey in the first place, because Chile went through a massive social uprising in 2019, where people were just fed up with the inequality in the country and were trying to rewrite the constitution to make Chile a more fair and equal place.
You know, the United States is dealing with that right now. We've got this discussion. I mean, a couple of years ago, nobody knew what the word oligarchy meant. And now it's something that is confronting us as we realize the fragility of our democracy and how, you know, the courts have decided that people with a lot of money, that's part of their free speech, that their money can talk. And I think with a bigger gap between rich and poor in Chile.
I would say so, yeah, for sure.
What can we learn when the United States, a lot of people don't really, aren't really concerned if a few rich people have more than their share because dollars talk. Well, dollars talk in Chile, is that good for the fabric of their democracy and good for the people, or is there trickle down? I mean,
no.
What can we learn?
No, I mean, absolutely. That is exactly what led to this huge social uprising. I mean, it was something that was just boiling under the surface for years and years and years, and there was little protest movements here and there, but then all of a sudden just exploded in October of 2019 and really is still a topic of dialogue here. You know, what can the outcomes of that big protest and riot movement be to change the country, which to this day hasn't really changed much?
What's the makeup of the teams? Is it the industrial elites that are combining with the political elites that are able to work together to keep the masses down?
Yeah, I would say certainly. And working together with certain religious organizations as well to shape cultural not changing anything in the culture.
Ah, okay. So that is taking these economic interests and pairing them with social wedge issues, and that gives them a critical mass.
Yeah, so Chile has tried twice now, because of this big social uprising, has tried twice now to change its constitution, but you can pick one issue. The first constitution that we voted for was too progressive for many because it gave lots of rights to indigenous communities. It gave gender parity in the government. It gave lots of rights to land, and it poked on some religious issues, abortion, among other things, that if any of those issues were things that you were against, you could vote against it. So 80% of the population wanted a new constitution, and then nearly just as many voted against the constitution that they were given. So it's been kind of a...
it's kind of a mess. I guess what I was getting at, I just wonder how comfortable can an American be flying into Santiago and being a tourist up in the desert.
Well, what I would say to that is that being a tourist in Chile, just as anywhere in the world, is one, you're contributing oftentimes to rural communities. You know, tourists are the ones who go out to these small towns where the people do not have much economic power. And so if tourists are not coming to visit these smaller towns, then those people are losing out on their chance to reach the middle class. So I think that tourism is actually a great way, and that tourists are very much welcome to come to all the countries of this part of the world.
Especially if their money goes to real local people.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that there is so much negative news that comes out of this part of the world that coming here really helps change your perspective, because you don't come here and you don't think about crime or the way the government's not working. What you see is, you know, interesting people, amazing food, landscapes that will blow your mind. That's what you take home with you. It's not the government's a mess, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with travel writer Mark Johansson, and he's joining us now from Santiago in Chile. And his book is Mars on Earth, Wandering the World's Driest Desert. Mark also writes about travel, food, design, and sustainability. You'll see his work in National Geographic, Travel and Leisure, The Economist, Condé Nast, and he's a co-author of Lonely Planet Guides. To learn more about Mark's work, you can see the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Mark, you wrote in your book that you were searching as you wandered the Atacama during a time of personal and political turmoil. You were seeking insight into yourself, into your adopted country, and into its place in the world. It's interesting that you wrote a chapter in the book called Message from Above, an oasis for outcasts, a place where New Age hippies would go to seek. And you went there to seek. You know, tell us about that dimension of the desert. Did it deliver for you? What was going on in your life, and what did the desert do?
Sure. You know, I think if you look at deserts all around the world, they're a landscape that tends to attract outcasts and outsiders. They open your mind up to big thinking. If you think about UFO sightings, why do they always happen in desert environments? And I think it has to do with this palpable connection you have in a desert between the earth and the sky, because it's just such a massive sky. You're looking up into
that's
the sky.
That's it. Yeah. A palpable connection between the earth and sky. That's why there's all the telescopes there.
Exactly,
Well, maybe you're not physically closer, but you can see it better.
You are kind of physically closer, though, because in a lot of places of the Atacama, you're up on the Altiplano.
Oh, there
you
go.
So you're above 13,000 feet. That's why a lot of these astronomy facilities are there, because the ultraviolet radiation is massive. The sky is just with this full sun that's a spotlight on you all day. And it can make you a little crazy, but sometimes that's fun to get yourself out of your comfort zone.
That's travel.
That's travel. Exactly. That's the fun of travel for me.
A lot of time you can learn more about your home by leaving it and looking at it from a distance.
Oh, absolutely.
And if that distance may be from the driest place on earth where the stars are the brightest, that may
exactly.
be a source of enlightenment. Wow. Mark Johansson, thanks so much for joining us. And thanks for writing, a fascinating book, Mars on Earth. Maybe someday I'll see you wandering, a crazed lunatic in the desert as the stars are twinkling and there's a big smile
on
your face.
Come save me if you find me wandering the desert, please.
I won't save you. I'll have you let me join you.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
All right. Hey, happy travels.
Thank you. You as well.
Mark posts articles that he's written about people and destinations in South America, from Patagonia to Easter Island to the Andes of Ecuador. It's on his website, markjohansson.com. His book about the Atacama Desert is called Mars on Earth. Next, we'll open the phone lines and check listener emails to us to hear how your travels have been going. We're at 877-333-7425. And radio at ricksteves.com is how you reach us by email, right here at Travel with Rick Steves. So how have your travels been going lately? Are you eager to get out there and make new friends who can brighten your day? Let us know a highlight or two from your recent adventures, or even something memorable from a while back, so that the rest of us can be inspired to explore the world too. We're at 877-333-RICK. Ed is calling in from Los Angeles. Ed, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Doing great. Have you been traveling anywhere interesting lately?
One of the best trips I've taken recently is with my son. We traveled to Ireland and to Scotland. One of the most memorable things about traveling to Scotland, it was a fall evening, and we were able to go to Edinburgh Castle just as the sun was setting, and it was just a magnificent sight, I have to tell you.
Mm. You know, I've been on Arthur's Seat just across the way. That's that craggy peak just across town from Edinburgh Castle. And when the sun is going down, all that sort of time-stained, stony architecture just takes on a special glow, and to be able to see the skyline of Edinburgh, and including the Edinburgh Castle, is just, it's a great spot to be, and that's that magic hour just when the sun's going down.
There's something about a northern European capital that is just a special place, not necessarily in the dead of winter, but in the fall, in the autumn. The weather is crisp, but it's not bone-chilling cold, and it's not the tourist season, so the town isn't flooded with tourists, and November is a wonderful time to go.
You said northern European town. I'm thinking Gdansk in Poland. I'm thinking Stockholm in Sweden with the archipelago and its fortifications, Tallinn in Estonia, Bergen in Norway. There's so many places. When you went to Edinburgh Castle, are you Scottish? Is that why it had a special impact on you?
Yes, actually. My father took me there when I was 11. We were able to go to the top. It was a beautiful November day as well. We traveled by train, and you know, we were there for the day, and we have some wonderful photographs from that time. It was the mid-70s. So I took my son to the same spot, and it just happened to be the same month, but it wasn't during the day. It was just at dusk, and it was just it was a magical, magical place. And we do have Scottish ancestry, but just something that you feel deep within your bones, deep within your soul.
especially where your kin is, where your tribe came from. I was in Scotland for a couple of weeks, and I'm not Scottish, but every time I came into a different region, you know, I'd go to the major clan castle, and each of those castles was like the spiritual homeland of that clan, and they would have the documents and the artifacts and the battle-dented armor and swords and all of the information so people who are tracking their genealogy could come there and connect all the dots. I must have gone to, boy, 8 or 9 different castles, and each one had that same power for the people of that clan. And I found it to be a beautiful experience. Each one was still lived in by the leading family, and they would post photographs of the man and the woman of the house and their children just to remind visitors who were paying to help them, you know, cover their costs, because it's hard to keep up a castle like that. But remind them that this is still a lived-in castle and it's a living history. And if you're from this clan, this is your spiritual homeland.
Yeah, that's very well put. All of those places are so welcoming, whether you have any historical roots there or not.
Yeah.
You know, we received the same wonderful welcoming reception in Ireland, all over the country, and we've just had such a magnificent time traveling with our children in Europe. It's a wonderful, magical place, and it's a great place to take your kids.
Ah, I was just going to think that's a great experience to share with your son there in Edinburgh. Ed, thanks for your call.
Very true. Very good talking to you, Rick.
You too. Bye now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Paul's calling in from Stillwater, Minnesota. Paul, thanks for your call.
Hello, Rick. Thanks for taking my call. So my wife and I finally are making it to Iceland. So I've been flying through Reykjavik for about 30 years now and never got outside the airport.
Oh, so, boy. Icelandicare has always had this wonderful stopover thing for budget travelers. Decades ago, everybody would fly through there, but a lot of people just hung out at the airport and caught another airplane. But you could take a few days and check out Iceland. That's what, you know, thousands and thousands of people are doing.
Right. Yep. So we've got about a week in Iceland now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we will be, given the amount of time that we have, the ring road is not probably on the radar on this trip. Seems to be take a longer than we have. So we'll be doing the Golden Circle. And then we'll be going down, I think, to the south coast. And one of the questions that I had was, I know from your book and from reading that, you know, you can do the Golden Circle in a long day trip from Reykjavik and come back to Reykjavik if you really, you know, if you really want to. But then you may not see all the less popular places along the way.
Right.
But we plan on, since we have time, to spend maybe a couple days actually in and around the Golden Circle.
Right.
Do you have any strong recommendations for, like, side trips on the Golden Circle?
Well, let's look at the bigger picture here. You got 5 days. You got to see Reykjavik, the capital, but you can see it in one busy day of sightseeing. You got the south coast, which is wonderful. The south coast is like everything you're looking for in Iceland, as far as I'm concerned. You got the Westman Islands, which I think the Westman Islands are just great. And you've got this Golden Circle, a long day loop inland from Reykjavik.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the Blue Lagoon, which is the touristy spa out by the airport. So if I was going to, you could spend 2 days on the Ring Road, or not the Ring Road. By the way, people who are thinking about doing the whole loop, that's called the Ring Road. Iceland is like totally uninhabited in the middle. And there's one road, Highway 1, that goes all around the island, 800 miles. And you wouldn't want to do it in 5 days. You could, but it's too much to do in the time that you've got. But what I would do, though, and I struggled with this because I thought the Golden Circle is so cool. Let's give it another day. But really, it's a charm bracelet of wonderful little straightforward things to knock off as you do it. There's not a lot. There's more to do in the way of side trips, I think, from the south coast than on the Golden Circle.
Okay.
So I would do 2 nights and 1 day in Reykjavik, 1 day for the Golden Circle. I would do 1 day on Westman Islands, and then I would do 2 days on the south coast. All along the south coast, there are little roads that go inland, and this is where you could have those side trips if you wanted to, and you could take those little hikes if you wanted to.
Good. Good to know. Okay, so yeah, so maybe that we revisit that.
Yeah, I'm not putting down the Golden Circle. I'm just saying it can be done in a sort of a efficient way, because you know, you're going to see the geyser, you're going to see a couple of great waterfalls, you're going to see the farm that makes everything out of tomatoes. You know, you're going to see the horse ranch. You're going to have your soup here with this wonderful rustic ambience. It's all pretty straightforward, and the main thing is it's a beautiful drive. And then you get back to Reykjavik, and the next morning you head for the south coast. One way you could spend a lot of extra time would be to hire a local tour company to do horse riding or these jeep trips that go, you know, cross country into the interior, which are really quite dramatic. But it doesn't sound like you're doing that. It sounds like you've got a rental car and you're just on your own, which is probably what I would do. But you're in the right track. I just think I would make the Golden Circle a very long day, and then I would have more time for the South Coast and the Westman Islands. One very important point is everybody spends $100 to go to the fancy spa, you know, the mineral hot springs at the Blue Lagoon. It's the big touristy thing that the tourist board really pushes out by the airport. Most people that I know who really love and know Iceland, they would rather go for $10 to just the town hot springs, you know, just the swimming pool where all the kids go. And that's a wonderful slice of local life. There's no tourist there. It's just local people. And it costs you $10 instead of $100. So you have that choice. But on the other hand, everybody's going to always ask you, did you do the Blue Lagoon? And then you'll always have to say, yeah. No, Rick Steves told me to do the little community bath. But you know, you can do both, yeah. I suppose. So, hey, thanks for your call, yeah. Paul.
Appreciate your advice. Thanks again, Rick.
Take care. Bye now. We're checking in with you, our listeners, to Travel with Rick Steves to hear your travel stories. By the way, if you email us a short travel yarn to radio@ricksteves.com, we might be able to read it the next time we record an open phone segment for the show. Or we could notify you when that is so we can talk in person. Michelle in Livermore, California emails us. Michelle writes, I was shopping at the flea market in Paris's Clignancourt and I found a blown glass lamp I wanted to buy. I didn't have enough cash. This was before they took credit cards. The shopkeeper let me take the lamp and said he'd pick up the money at my hotel's front desk after I went to the bank. My hotel was a half-hour metro ride from his shop. I took the lamp. I promised him I'd leave the money. He came by and got the money. Who in the United States would do that for anyone, especially a foreigner? That's a good point. You'll be surprised at how friendly and trusting the people you meet in Europe can be. And Michelle has a very nice memory, as well as a nice glass lamp from the flea market in Paris. And Ethna's calling from Orlando. Ethna, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Rick. I enjoyed your program about Belgium so much that I had to let you know I had lived in Belgium for 5 years and just loved living in that country. Hard to believe that it's just the size of the state of Maryland, but a beautiful place to live.
Really is, isn't it? It's sort of in the middle of Europe. You can just, within a couple of hours, you're in Paris or Amsterdam or the Rhine River or London.
Yep, very convenient and a great integration of cultures and nationalities.
Well, it is. It's essentially a bilingual country, right? So you've got French-speaking people and Flemish-speaking people, like Dutch. What part of the country did you live in?
Yes, I lived in Brussels, but I worked at the airport, which is in the Dutch-speaking part. And interestingly, when I got the job, I was hired because I was bilingual in French. And when I got there, found out that the airport in Zaventem is in the Flemish-speaking part of the country. And the airport director, he was Flemish, and every weekly meeting that we had for the airline station managers, the meetings were conducted in English. So it was very funny because when I told my boss that he hired me for the job because of my bilingual in French, but I really only used my French when I was off the job on the weekends or, you know, my days off or whatever. So it was very funny.
Did you feel that there was any sort of a tension between the Flemish and the French-speaking population in that single country?
Sometimes, you know, with politics, that's the way it is sometimes. But at the airport, my staff were, they were trilingual. They spoke Flemish, English, and French, but they were very, very got along very, very well together, even though some were Flemish and some were French, Walloon, as they're called.
So you could actually function in English in a country where English was the third language, really, after Flemish and French. I've noticed in the airports in Belgium and in the Netherlands, English is so widely spoken, and there's so many people flying through and so on, that they almost dispense with the local language, and signs are in English only.
Yep, that was how it was when I worked there. I had a funny incident one day. One of the agents who was Flemish-speaking, the customer got off the airplane and said, where can I get a drink of water? And the agent said, she had a very sweet accent, and she said, you can just go over there and drink from the toilet. And the word in French for a toilet, of course, is toilette, but that means bathroom. And she was sending her to the to get from the water fountain, but she said you could drink from the toilet.
So she was saying go to the restroom and get a drink.
Yes,
and she said drink. Oh, there's a good example of a little bit of a language problem.
Right.
I would have think, what did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve this treatment? Go drink from the toilet.
Right. And the lady was American, of course, and she looked at her and she says, drink from the toilet? And then I interceded and I said, she means the bathroom's over there. There's a water fountain. You can drink from the water fountain, you know, and I explained what toilette meant.
Oh, yeah.
It was very funny.
Well, it's a fascinating country to travel in. And if you're in Brussels, for instance, you're within less than an hour. You can be at every one of the great sites in the country, whether it's Bruges or Ghent or Antwerp. It's just fascinating. And the people are so well educated and things are so well organized. And they've got a wonderful respect for their heritage and they're investing in the future. It's just, to me, it's kind of like the epitome of Europe.
Yeah.
If you want a microcosm of Europe, you go to Belgium, and it's no wonder that the headquarters of the European Union is right there in Brussels.
Right. And NATO.
And NATO, too. That's right.
Yes.
Well, Ethna, thanks so much for your call. Happy travels.
Thank you, Rick. I love your program.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Corey's calling from Sacramento. Corey, thanks for your call.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to ask you a question. I'm actually going to Italy on my honeymoon, starting off in Venice and then going down to Florence, Positano, and back at finishing up in Rome. So I'm really looking for, like, this super romantic idea that I can do with my wife on our honeymoon that will just, you know, kind of blow her socks off.
Right. I have a friend who's a taxi driver in Sorrento, and his name's Raphael. And he is the coolest gentleman. And if he knew that he was part of your honeymoon, you would have the luxurious limousine kind of treatment. I mean, he's just a cabbie, but he's a wonderful guy who speaks English. He's sort of quintessential Italian. And if you hired him for a day for exploring the Amalfi Coast, including Positano, he could meet you in Positano, by the way, if you're already staying there, which is the most romantic place to stay is Positano. Raphael could meet you for the day and drive you around. And if you let him know you were looking for romantic moments, he knows all the places. So I would recommend having a driver for the Amalfi Coast. So that's one thing that comes to mind. In Rome, I would go to a restaurant called Il Gabriello. Il Gabriello. It's about a five-minute walk from the Spanish Steps. And it's run by a wonderful chef named Claudio. And let him know that he'll serve you at your table. And let him know it's your honeymoon, and you'll have experience in Rome you will never forget. The main thing in Florence to have a romantic time is not to be standing in lines. And, you know, because it is just exasperating, all the lines in Florence, because everybody wants to go to the same places. But I would recommend, and this is a new thing for me, the Pitti Palace, and the Pitti Palace with a local tour guide who's an art historian. Because the Pitti Palace is a luxurious, just a lavish palace, completely hung with gorgeous art. And the most famous pieces of art are in the Uffizi Gallery, and that's where all the tourists go because it's kind of a bucket list thing. But if you want this holistic, artistic, cultural, palatial, romantic, Medici, Florence Renaissance experience, go to the Pitti Palace with a local guide. Italians are really romantic. So if they know it's your honeymoon, know how to say luna di mille. That's the word for honeymoon, luna di mille, while you're in Italy. And, you know, play the honeymoon card as much as you can.
Awesome. That's great to know. One of the things that I think we're looking at doing when we're in Florence is taking kind of like a Tuscan, you know, wine excursion out to the Tuscan countryside and hitting up San Gimignano, seeing, you know, the medieval town.
Yeah.
If you're going to San Gimignano, it's a hot, sweaty, disgusting, commercial, touristic zoo during the day.
Okay.
In other words, I don't like it. But after hours, it's great. If you went to San Gimignano for dinner and then had a walk with the floodlit town after hours, nobody's there. It's just you in this most gorgeous town. But during the day, you can't get a place to park your tour bus. There's so many tour buses there, and it is the tackiest tourism. So I want to make it really clear. You want to steer away from the tourist crowds in the day in San Gimignano. Hey, Corey, I just thought of something in Florence that could really be a very cool thing. Uh-huh. I'm not an artist. I've never had any painting experience or anything like that. But I went to a fresco painting workshop, and an artist taught me and my friends how to make a fresco. And we were copying a Michelangelo figure, and I did a bust of a woman from the Renaissance, and it turned out so great. And I had an artist hold my hand and help me through the whole process of making a fresco, and it was a treasure. I've still got it on my wall in my office. And I think if you and your wife-to-be had a fresco time and you each made a fresco of each other with the instruction of the local artist, that would be really cool.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea. I really like that.
It's a souvenir about the size of a regular piece of copy paper or regular notebook paper. And it is the actual fresco process that all the great artists did, in past centuries. It's it'll cost you a few $100, but boy, what a special souvenir of your time together in Florence on your honeymoon.
Absolutely. That sounds like something that, would be cherished forever.
It sure would. All right. Hey, thanks for calling and best wishes on your trip. What a great, exciting thing to look forward to.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kasmira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of trekking the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my journal and vivid photos from that coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary hippie trail. My book, On the Hippie Trail, is available wherever books are sold.